Welcome to Season 6 of Inspiring West Virginians. I'm Jean Snediger. In the next hour, you're going to hear from four outstanding West Virginians, a young chemical engineer and yet world authority in his field at WVU.
You could just tell that Brian was destined to do great things.
A global executive from the IT industry.
Marilyn is perpetually visionary. She really is inspirational. My hero.
A man designing the computers of the future.
Rod is an incredibly enthusiastic scientist. He is not afraid of jumping into a new topic and asking the right questions.
And a revolutionary entrepreneur.
What is amazing about Karen is that she truly cares. From the moment she wakes up in the morning until she falls asleep at night, she's making a difference.
The stories of scientists, engineers, and business people. We like to call these folks inspiring West Virginians. First, a man from Roane County who's working towards West Virginia's energy future.
Recently in science, it was reported that West Virginia is a geothermal hotspot. Now, really, that probably would surprise a lot of you.
Professor Brian Anderson, a chemical engineer and director of the West Virginia University Energy Institute, giving a TED Talk in Pittsburgh.
But it is, in fact, a pretty good geothermal resource. So if we can find cheap ways...
37-year-old Brian Anderson, a native of Roane County, is a global expert on geothermal energy. That is, energy we get from deep beneath the Earth's surface. As he calls it, the heat under our feet.
A few years ago, some colleagues of mine at Southern Methodist University, in collaboration with Google, identified a hotspot here in West Virginia, where it really seems that the best geothermal resources here close to the East Coast happen to be here in the mountains of West Virginia. And so that really excites me for sure. A native West Virginian interested in geothermal energy, it just seems serendipitous. It's not the most economical here, but that's where we come in. That's where advanced research comes in. That's what we're trying to do, is find ways that it can be simultaneously environmentally friendly and economical and can help us provide a new and additional energy source from the state of West Virginia.
Anderson is not just interested in geothermal energy, for which he received his PhD from MIT. He's the world's leading authority on gas hydrates, an untapped resource under the oceans and in Arctic regions. And, as director of the Energy Institute in Morgantown, he oversees research into wind power, solar power, biomass, oil, shale gas, and coal production, among others. In 2013, Anderson won the President's Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers.
The White House, April 11th, 2014. Where are you in there?
I'm on the back row, three over from the President, wearing the red tie. Right
there. Oh, yes, I see you. Okay.
In the decades to come, Brian Anderson believes all types of energy will be produced and used more locally. Experts call it distributed generation.
It's much like eating locally from locally produced farms and the like. If we can produce our energy in a much more local manner, then I think we start heading more towards sustainability. In West Virginia, maybe we can use a considerable amount of our geothermal and our wind and our solar and using our natural gas resources if we can do it sustainably, and even our coal. You know, we still have a huge coal resource in West Virginia, so we're really trying to work on ways that we can do that while minimizing its CO2 footprint, while minimizing its environmental impact. But we have been blessed with a resource, and it's our job to try to figure out how we can use that resource and use it sustainably.
Making coal production more environmentally friendly is a professional goal. But for Brian Anderson, it's also personal.
So my grandfather, my father's father, was a coal miner, just passed away this year. My dad grew up in a coal camp and just outside of Montgomery. And, you know, I'm a West Virginian. I have coal running in my blood. I am... very mindful of what the resources we have provided to us and what they've taken away. So my grandfather, it was amazing. He lived to be 87 years old for decades of that with black lung. So for me, working in West Virginia is really a mandate. So I grew up for the first 11 years of my life on a road called Grace Road. Grace Road is between Reedy and Spencer, West Virginia, in Roan County. And about 2 miles out, Grace Road is a little community called Grace Community.
Brian Anderson's rural West Virginia roots run deep.
So we're turning now onto State Route 14, heading south toward Grace Road. And so as you see, this road's a nice, tight little windy road.
It's absolutely beautiful.
We just passed Wagon Run Road, and here this is the Woods Farm. On the right, this hillside is where we would come sleigh riding, usually on an inner tube. So we're approaching the house I grew up in.
Okay.
This is really the heart of the community and the densest part of the population, all 12 houses, if I'm being generous here. So here on the left, this little three-bedroom house, you know, I had my own bedroom as a kid. I was blessed. I really was blessed. And I was allowed to ride my bike to the park, right here to this steel pole entrance to the park.
A large, beautiful community park with a creek running through it.
This was my playground. As you can see my house from here. As long as it wasn't dark outside, I had to be home by dusk, but as long as I was either here at the park or in the yard at the house, my parents felt safe. It was a wonderful, wonderful place to grow up.
Brian and his sister went to school 2 miles away in Reedy.
Gene, we've just stopped along the road, and we're actually sitting on the remnants of what used to be the railroad that ran here through Reedy, West Virginia. We're about to enter Reedy, which is where I went to elementary school, where my mother was the principal.
In the early 1900s, Reedy, West Virginia was a boomtown due to the railroad and a steam-driven flour mill. It had its own hospital, newspaper, two banks, and a department store. But now it's smaller, with fewer businesses.
This was the second biggest town that I was used to. Spencer was the big town for me, but this was the center of my universe for the first 11 years of my life.
I'm Paulette Nestor. I'm Brian Anderson's mother. I'm a retired elementary school principal after being in education for 33 years. When Brian was a young child, he was very inquisitive. He would ask questions nonstop. There were times that we would be driving and he would be asking questions and answering them himself before any of us would answer for him. One time on a 45-minute drive, the rest of the family decided to be quiet. And Brian continued talking and asking questions and answering.
When Brian was 8 years old, his parents divorced, and when he was 11, he moved with his mother to Ripley, where he graduated valedictorian from Ripley High School, before going to WVU as a Foundation Scholar, the university's top scholarship for undergraduates. Anderson's 90-year-old maternal grandfather, John Paul Poling, spent most of his career as a maintenance supervisor at Kaiser Aluminum, but is also a writer, poet, local historian, and inventor. He remembers his grandson was always at the head of his class and very curious about how things work.
What I remember about Brian, he was always one that liked to tinker with something. And of course, well, he was here visiting us, you know. He liked to ask questions. And I've always been one myself, would like to follow through with some invention, trying to improve something. And he'd always, what am I doing? Why are you doing this? He comes to visit. I ask him, you know, about his work and all. And my prayer is that the Lord will continue to use him.
Gene, we just crossed this little wooden bridge and we're pulling into the parking lot at Gilboa Baptist Church. My family is a spiritual and religious family, and so along with the Baptist heritage and the teachings of the church, it really comes down to the golden rule for my family and really treating others as you want to be treated. And with that, you know, it comes to also treating strangers like their friends and treating friends like their family. I first started singing in Gilboa Baptist Church in Roane County on Grace Road, and singing and music became one of my passions. My mother is an incredible pianist and singer, and I was, as a kid, just surrounded by great church music. But it wasn't until my junior year in high school that I joined a choir for the first time.
Brian continued to sing in choirs at WVU and at MIT, where he discovered that lots of scientists and engineers are interested in music.
And then finally auditioned for what is called the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, which is the house chorus for the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Brian Anderson singing Bruckner's Virga Jesse Floreat with the Tanglewood Festival Chorus. The chorus also provided music for two Hollywood films. Secular, secular.
One movie is Mystic River, which was directed by Clint Eastwood, and it was filmed largely in Boston, and he used the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the Tanglewood Festival Chorus to provide part of the score.
Gene Salento, the dean of the College of Engineering and Mineral Resources at WVU, always knew that Brian Anderson would do well.
I met Brian in 1995 when he came into the program as an undergraduate student, a foundation scholar. You could just tell that Brian was destined to do great things.
How could you tell it?
Just because he has a very bubbly personality, very extroverted, was very inquisitive, asked questions, was engaged, involved. You could tell he loved West Virginia. He loved the university and he loved his degree he was working on. But you can see Brian's probably among the top 1 or 2% of students I've had the pleasure of having taught.
In 38 years, yeah.
As soon as he finished his postgraduate work at MIT, Brian Anderson returned to West Virginia University to teach and do research. Nevertheless, other top research institutions also wanted Brian Anderson. They've tried to lure him away. In 2014, one almost succeeded, Gordon Gee, president of West Virginia University.
Right after I came, I determined that it's in the interest of this state for us to establish a world-class energy institute, given what we are doing and given the qualities of this state, and we needed to have a world-class leader. And we had a young man here by the name of Brian Anderson who had just been recruited to go to Switzerland to head one of their major research programs. And I stopped him at the airport and said, "You've got to stay with us." I stopped him at the border. And we've made him the head of our energy institute here, and he's doing a wonderful job.
Is it true that you sort of threatened him about what we were going to do to him if he left?
Yeah, I told him I'd break his leg, and he's a little bit bigger than I am, as you know. He's a wonderful, handsome guy and an opera singer to boot. We don't want to export our talent. We don't mind if they go other places, but we want to have them come home. And I think that that is an inspirational story, someone who has gone away, has performed brilliantly academically, and has had a great professional life in front of him, but yet who made a decision that West Virginia was his home, and he's going to come home and do well here and do right here.
What I love about my job is working with so many great minds with so many wonderful ideas. And the fact that part of my job is shouting from the rooftops how great the faculty and the students and the researchers are at WVU. And I love being able to try to work with all of these researchers and put together a bigger vision so that we are much better known on the national stage. You know, I have grand visions of West Virginia becoming a rich state, both rich in resources and rich in our healthy lifestyles. My hopes and dreams for myself really are that I can help contribute to finding energy solutions and do it to where three generations from now we leave them the same beautiful West Virginia that we have today. You know, I just want to be a part of that.
A lot of that, I think, comes from the fact that he is a West Virginian, and we're dealing with West Virginia energy. We're dealing with West Virginia's future.
West Virginia is what made me who I am, and it's such an integral part of who I am that it really means everything to me, and it will never, never, ever leave me.
You're listening to Inspiring West Virginians. Next, a woman from the Kanawha Valley who is a global business leader.
Oh, Jean, we're on Pennsylvania Avenue now. This is the direct route from the White House to the nation's capital, so the president going back and forth to work.
Marilyn Johnson, CEO of one of the most prestigious women's organizations in the world, the International Women's Forum, headquartered in Washington, D.C. Johnson grew up in the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia.
My earliest and fond memory of this was as a sixth grader at Vandalia Elementary School. I was selected to represent the patrol, the safety patrol troop, and march down Pennsylvania Avenue. That was probably my foray into leadership.
And I remember a former global executive for IBM, today Marilyn Johnson is one of the most high-profile African-American businesswomen in the country. And from the time she was a small child, Johnson, the middle of five children, had a fire in her belly to succeed. But being from an African-American family in the Kanawha Valley of the 1950s, there were certainly hurdles to overcome.
Being born in West Virginia in 1953 in South Charleston was truly an opportunity for me to grow up in an integrated environment. But my parents were smart enough to put me from Sunday school into kindergarten, where it was literally in the garage of a lady, a teacher, probably a retired teacher, because I remember Miss Catherine was older and very beautiful. And she taught me how to read. And she taught me my colors. And she taught me how to spell my name and write my name. That education I got through church and Miss Catherine's garage was Head Start before Head Start had a title. So I had confidence.
Despite that confidence, when she started first grade at Central Elementary School in St. Albans, many of the children didn't want to play with Marilyn. Indeed, they had been told not to play with her. So she set a strategy that she would define herself. They wouldn't.
If there was a spelling bee, I wanted to be one of the last ones standing. If we all had to go to the chalkboard to do math, I took my time to print neatly, check my work before they called on me to explain my problem and how. I wanted to excel, and I had educators that saw more in me, I think, than I saw in myself.
People like her fifth grade teacher, Miss Johnson.
Miss Johnson in the fifth grade really made me feel like I could soar. And I'll never forget just feeling comfortable in her presence. She never yelled, raised her voice. She wasn't an imposing personality. Quiet, smart, serene, and I wanted to be so much like her. And her name was Johnson, and maybe I'm related to her. I would daydream.
In junior high, Marilyn made the honor roll. She also excelled in sports and cheerleading.
Being the first Black cheerleader of South Charleston Junior High School was challenging because I had to befriend young women who had a whole different background than I did. But I remember Donna and Penny and Beth. I remember these young girls that treated me like I was from their neighborhood. They made me feel one of the core.
When Marilyn was nine, her parents divorced. Then, right before high school, she went to live with her grandmother and blind great-grandmother in Bell, West Virginia, to help out, and went to DuPont High School, where she was a cheerleader and vice president of her class. One teacher, Beverly Conklin, made a huge impression.
She was so compassionate and so understanding because she knew I was living with a grandmother helping take care of a great-grandmother and the responsibilities I had at home. She really was encouraging and supportive and predicted my success and even told me later, I always knew you would go far in this world. I'm so proud of you. For a teacher to tell you 20 years later that they saw in you what you're living, it brings tears to my eyes. So I'll never forget her. She was wonderful.
At Marshall, Marilyn Johnson was the head cheerleader in the years immediately following the 1970 plane crash disaster that killed more than 70 Thundering Herd players, coaches, and boosters. It was a somber time when the football team was rebuilding. She also became Miss Huntington, worked as the weekend weather girl at WSAZ-TV, and earned 2 master's degrees in education. But after teaching briefly in Cabell County, Johnson headed for California to interview with IBM.
I knew from the very first conversation with the very first manager at IBM that if I invested in my career the way I invested in my education in West Virginia, it was a meritocracy. The better performance that you delivered, the more opportunities that you would receive. And with that comes leadership, compensation, escalation, and success, defined by moving up that corporate ladder.
Which is exactly what Johnson did. Over a period of 35 years, while raising her 2 children, she went from showing customers how to use IBM business equipment to vice president in charge of developing IBM strategy for marketing to businesses that were owned by ethnically diverse people and women leaders around the world. In that role, she expanded IBM's market share significantly. When she retired in 2012, IBM had nearly 400,000 employees in more than 70 countries, and it remains an iconic leader in the IT industry.
My name is Denise Evans, and I am the Vice President for Women and Diversity Marketing at the IBM Corporation.
Denise Evans succeeded Marilyn Johnson at IBM. They worked together 8 years.
It was a great partnership. Marilyn is perpetually visionary. She's a lifelong learner. She really is inspirational. And I'm more the analytic, getting things done, operational kind of person. So it was just great working for her. She's always uplifting. Even when maybe giving constructive criticism, it's uplifting. She brings out the better side of you.
Johnson's position at IBM gave her the opportunity to serve on the boards of numerous business, professional, and civic organizations, both nationally and internationally. She took me to one that holds a special place in her heart.
We are now passing the National Council of Negro Women headquarters. This is the only building on Pennsylvania Avenue owned by African Americans. This building is dedicated to Dr. Dorothy Irene Height. I served on her board proudly for 8.5 years, representing IBM as a corporate liaison and helping institutionalize this landmark.
Dorothy Height and her mentor, Mary McLeod Bethune, championed the cause of African American women during the administrations of 13 presidents, from Roosevelt to Obama.
Dr. Dorothy Height knew the importance of the presence of the voice of women of color on this avenue. So I worked with IBM and some executives there to help raise money to pay the mortgage off before her death, and we were successful in doing so. I'm still a member of the National Council of Negro Women. As we get to the edge of the building,
the road from Central Elementary School in St. Albans, West Virginia, to the top of an iconic IT company doesn't seem obvious. But in Marilyn's case, subtle pressure began at home.
The whole conversation at dinner was what happened in school today, and what did you learn, and where are you going to go to college? My father never asked us, are you going to college? His question was always, which one and why?
I'm Jack Johnson. I'm Marilyn Johnson's father, and I'm very proud of Marilyn.
There was an expectation of education.
There wasn't no expectation. It was a demand that you will go to college. You will achieve.
Why did you tell him that?
Because I believe strongly in education. That's the key to success. And evidently, Marilyn believed it. The others did too, because they all went.
87-year-old Jack Johnson, a retired Army colonel, still lives in St. Albans. He remembers his young daughter as being impatient.
I remember telling her once, and she was a teenager, if you worked for me, I would fire you. She said, fire me? I said, yes. You heard of men being pushy, but But when women are pushy, they're not acceptable. And you are pushy. But it was her nature. She wanted to climb each ladder.
When she was a youngster, when you told her she was a bit pushy, where did you think she would end up?
Not far, because opportunities were not great for blacks, especially black women. Black women, white and any other color, were restricted. Jobs weren't open to them. Never did I expect her to achieve as much as she has. Remember, when she was born, nobody got to be a vice president.
Here is a stack of magazines with your daughter on the cover.
It's Marilyn.
It's Marilyn.
It's Marilyn. Uh-huh. Sad story of this.
Marilyn's mother, 84-year-old Exa Madison, lives in Rand, West Virginia, and still works full-time at a restaurant on McCorkle Avenue in Kanawha City. We met right after her shift.
She was determined, always feeling that she had to fight her way because she had an older brother and sister. So she was always pushing to be, as she now likes to call herself, the middle child. She's always been aggressive. She's extremely intelligent, and anything that she sets her mind to pursue, she conquers.
Uh-huh. And that's been a pattern in her life.
Yes. Whatever mountain she sought to climb, she reached the peak.
But she never forgot her friends in West Virginia. Most of her closest friends today are those she met in grade school, like Marty Jackson Luke from Charleston.
Marilyn was always loyal. If I would tell her secrets, she would keep them. If I wanted her to help me with do something, she would. She was just always there for me.
Of all the things that Marilyn has done, of which there are a lot of what are you the most proud?
That she didn't change as she went up the social economic scale. She stayed the same Marilyn that she's always been. A lot of people change, but she hasn't.
After her retirement from IBM, Marilyn Johnson continued her volunteer service to various business, civic, and arts organizations, as well as public speaking work. Then her career took a unique twist. She was pursued by the Wilhelmina Modeling Agency to become a mature model. Johnson appeared in numerous ads for national brands and did voiceovers for commercials. Then, in 2014, came the biggest challenge of Marilyn Johnson's career. She was invited to be the new chief executive officer of the International Women's Forum.
Our leadership development experience helps women in 33 countries, in 24 time zones, on 6 continents, find their voice, find their network, educate on expert topics, and raise their influence level around the world. There are 6,200 members currently connected through technology and then meeting face-to-face in conferences that are held around the world.
This global network of preeminent women leaders across all fields and professions not only comes together to help each other, but it also provides programs to develop future women leaders.
Marilyn Johnson's leadership style, first and foremost, is one of inclusiveness.
Chad Fleming, one of the managing directors of the International Women's Forum.
Watching her lead the International Women's Forum, it's very clear that she's mission-driven. She's a woman of integrity, tradition, but also of innovation. And I think that her growing up in West Virginia allowed her to really strengthen all of those traits.
Of course, another draw to take the new position in Washington, D.C., was that it brought Marilyn Johnson, the little girl from the Kanawha Valley, closer to home and family.
My parents are in their 80s. This makes it really convenient. I can be home in just a few hours. I can wake up and know that I can have lunch or dinner or both with my parents in West Virginia. So when I go home, I go to West Virginia. There is a true benefit to being from a place that wants you to succeed and wants you to represent the best of its values. And we're small enough as a state
to claim and know each other. Yet we're broad enough in talent and skill to touch the whole world.
You're listening to Inspiring West Virginians, scientists, engineers, and business people from the Mountain State. Next, a man from Mingo County working at the cutting edge of information technology.
Gene, I've been here at Duke as a visiting professor for almost a year now, and my time here is winding down. So I think I want to take you and show you a couple of places here on campus that I have taken to frequenting during my time here. I'm Rod Van Meter. I grew up in Williamson in Mingo County, and I'm a quantum computer and quantum network architect and an associate professor at Keio University in Japan. And the campus that I work at is the Shonan Fujisawa campus, which is about an hour southwest of Tokyo near the coast. You can see we're in a fabulous three-story high atrium here. And you see as we come up the stairs here that we get a beautiful view of the Duke Chapel.
Wow. Wow.
I like to sit here in the mornings with my laptop and my tea and work. So I'll sit here sometimes for 2 or 3 hours in the morning.
For the last year, 49-year-old Rod Van Meter has been on a fellowship at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. He's one of just a few thousand scientists and engineers in the world working on the future of IT, quantum computers and networks.
Quantum computing, in layman's terms, is using individual atoms and electrons and photons to calculate the results of certain functions that we can't figure out how to calculate efficiently using the regular kinds of computers that are in your cell phone or on your laptop or on your desktop, or what we call classical computers. So what we would like to achieve with quantum computing is to solve certain kinds of problems faster than classical computers. And by faster, what we mean in this case is we would like for them to be exponentially faster.
Once they are built, quantum computers could be 1,000 times faster, or 1,000,000 times faster, or even 1,000,000,000,000 times faster than computers are today. According to Van Meter, quantum computing will be a dramatic paradigm shift that will open up new opportunities, new fields and applications that no one has yet even imagined. And in other cases, it will simply solve big problems faster.
The single most famous example, and the one that really ignited interest in the field, is factoring large numbers. You know that 15 equals 3 times 5. Finding those factors is easy for small numbers, but it's very hard for large numbers for classical computers to achieve. It's used in the kinds of encryption that we use for security on the internet. And so if a simple method for factoring these numbers came along, that would have lots of implications for national security as well as general e-commerce.
When am I going to be able to go out and buy a quantum computer?
My answer to that is always 5 to 10 years after one of the really large technology companies decides to put $1 billion into this. Because there are a lot of engineering problems that have to be solved that are difficult to solve in a small-scale research environment.
And it may be coming sooner than we think. You may have heard of Moore's Law from Gordon Moore, co-founder of Intel. He predicted that processor speeds, or overall processing power for computers, will double every 2 years. And for most of the last 50 years, that has been true.
But we're getting to the point now where the transistors inside these devices are being built out of just a handful of atoms. Inside the computer chip, inside your laptop today, there are billions of transistors, and each individual transistor is maybe only 50 to 100 atoms across. Now, every year, Intel and the other semiconductor companies in the industry, they make the technology better and they shrink the size of those transistors. That means we're going to be hitting a very hard limit sometime soon because we don't know how to build computer chips out of less than a single atom per transistor.
And how computers are connected to share information and processing power will change too. The very first book in the world on quantum networking, published in 2014, was written by Rod Van Meter.
The idea behind quantum networking is to create shared quantum states that extend across some sort of distance. And those shared quantum states behave in ways that classical states can't. It uses a phenomenon that's called quantum entanglement, which is kind of like probability, but the quantum systems behave in a different way than classical systems do. And we can use that entanglement, once we've created it using that network, to do several different things.
Yes, it does rather sound like science fiction. Historically, when big leaps are made in science, it's often the physicists who lead the way, and then the engineers come along and make it work, make it practical. Junsang Kim is a physicist and professor of computer and electrical engineering at Duke University. For the last year, Kim and Van Meter have been working together, trying to solve some huge problems in the way of building quantum computers and quantum networks.
Rod is an incredibly enthusiastic and energetic scientist. He has a very diverse interest. He is not afraid of jumping into a new topic and asking the right questions. In terms of quantum computing, the physicists think about building small devices, but in order to really solve a problem on a processor, you have to think about how the problem maps onto a concrete hardware. In that front, Rod has made significant contributions in finding efficient algorithms to do the same task, given the connectivity or the hardware attributes that one may be able to build.
Rod Van Meter is socializing with some of his students at Keio University in Japan, where he's worked for the last 10 years. He was recruited to Keio by the man who brought the internet to Japan.
At our campus, the students actually join our research groups, usually starting in their second year, their sophomore year. So they work with us for 3 years and sometimes even 4 years on projects. I love it. I love having that direct contact with the students. And I'm very interested in science for its own sake, but what I really want to see, and what a lot of the other faculty members at my university in Japan want to see, is we want to see the science and technology have a positive impact on the world. We want to make the world a better place.
The 6 a.m. bell at Hongakuchi Buddhist Temple, built in 1436 and not far from Rod's home in Kamakura. On a previous work assignment here, Rod Van Meter met and married his wife, Mayumi. They have 2 teenage daughters. But despite living 6,000 miles away, Rod still makes it back to West Virginia every year.
You can leave West Virginia without leaving West Virginia behind. In that sense, I guess I will always carry both my family and West Virginia in my heart.
While he was at Duke, he came home to Williamson every month.
Early in the morning and right after it rains, the birds are especially lively. You can hear them sort of chattering in the background.
We're outside Rod's old school, Williamson High School.
The Williamson High School's closed now. It closed a year or two ago.
What was your favorite class here?
My favorite class was definitely advanced biology, which I took with Jack Phillips, who died just a couple years ago. Taking physics with Jack New was also wonderful. You can hear the train whistle blowing in the background there. That's now the Norfolk and Southern. It was still the Norfolk and Western when I was a kid, the N&W. So to me, the sound of that diesel horn is really the sound of Williamson. And I used to lie awake at night, on nights when I couldn't sleep. And to me, it's kind of a lonely but comforting sound. My family is very, very close, and we have stayed close despite the distance. It's possible to do that. You have to put in a lot of effort, and we do.
This weekend, Rod's family have gathered in Williamson to celebrate his father's birthday.
I am Linda Hatfield Van Meter, mother of Rod Van Meter III.
And I'm Doyle Van Meter, father of Rod Van Meter.
Rod was a pretty easy child to get along with. He did have a lot of illnesses when he was young, and that was probably the thing we had to deal with the most, was keeping him healthy.
Rod was highly asthmatic as a child.
I always remember Rod as being a very curious young man.
When did you recognize that he might be gifted or smarter than the average kid? Let's put it that way.
I don't think we did. His sisters were bright, too. Nobody ever said he was brighter than anyone else. He just, you know, he's just an ordinary kid.
But his seventh grade math teacher thought differently, and so did the school counselor.
The junior high school counselor, Wally Kahn, got a letter from Johns Hopkins where they were conducting a program called the Study of Mathematically Precocious Youth. And they asked talented seventh graders to take the SAT test. And for those who got a high enough score on the SAT test, they were then invited to participate in a summer program where we learned Algebra 1 and Algebra 2. That sort of set the stage for accelerated academic progress for me and the idea that I could actually become a scientist or an engineer.
By the time Rod finished two summer programs at Johns Hopkins, he was so far ahead of the other students that he skipped two grades and graduated from high school at 16. In there somewhere, he managed to become an Eagle Scout before going to the California Institute of Technology, where he was taught by Nobel laureate Richard Feynman, one of the first scientists to conceive the possibility of quantum computers.
And if Wally had ignored that letter, if she had just taken it and tossed it in the garbage instead of saying, well, we've got several students I think would benefit from this and who should take a shot at this, it's really hard to say where I would have wound up. Serendipitous events wind up changing life for a lot of people.
Rod's sisters, Sheila and Lyra, who both live and work in West Virginia, remember what Rod had to overcome to succeed.
Rod was sickly as a child growing up. He's asthmatic and allergic to everything. So he had a childhood of being pretty rough. I think he was at the emergency room probably once a week.
He was there a lot, and he would miss school because he had gotten into poison ivy or something when he was doing a leaf project for school. And I remember waking up a lot of times with our great Aunt Helen in the house because Mom and Dad had taken him to the hospital in the middle of the night.
Then that also caused him to read a lot. And I think that's probably where his huge vocabulary came from, is because he was reading.
When he was younger, he was always building with Erector sets. Mm-hmm. He was experimenting with things, and he was going to be the inventor in the family.
After graduating from Caltech, Van Meter held a series of IT jobs in Southern California and the Silicon Valley, eventually did a master's in computer engineering, got to work with some of the pioneers of the internet, then went on to earn his PhD at Keio University in Japan. Van Meter reminds his students that the world faces a rapid pace of change, so he encourages them to reinvent themselves every 5 years, which he also aims to do. So in a world of continuous change, Rod Van Meter seeks out places of solace, what he calls alone time. In Japan, it's on his bicycle commute to work. And at Duke, it's either at the atrium or the chapel.
I like to come in here at lunch sometimes and just listen to the organ. The organists play at lunchtime several times a week.
The true ingredient of success in my mind is how much passion you have in whatever you're pursuing. Rod is very passionate. He's very energetic about the questions that inspires him. If you can find that burning question that makes you go, like Rod has done through his career, I think that's something that you need to learn from. He's truly inspiring.
What I'm most proud of my brother for is the fact that he was able to do something in a field that I had never even dreamed would ever exist when we were kids. There was no understanding whatsoever of quantum computing because we didn't even grow up with much in the way of computers at all. They didn't exist in regular households. And the fact that he has done it to the extreme level to where he presents all over the world and still has such a good relationship with his own wife and daughters and with us, that just really shows how special he is.
I'm most proud of my brother, the research he's done, and he does it in respects of how can it make the world a better place. He has never been about the money. Everything about him makes me proud to say he belongs to us.
He's ours.
He's ours.
For our final story, a woman from McDowell County who has profoundly affected the lives of millions of people worldwide.
Join me in congratulating the 2015 Aegis Award winners, Worth and Barbara Caldwell.
The grand ballroom at the Multnomah Athletic Club in downtown Portland, Oregon. More than 300 people are here to celebrate the accomplishments of older Americans who are making a significant contribution to their communities.
The youngest of the three today.
But people are here partly because of the accomplishments of today's organizer, one of America's foremost gerontologists. She's the pioneer of assisted living in the United States and worldwide.
What is amazing about Karen is that she truly cares. From the moment she wakes up in the morning until she falls asleep at night, she's making a difference.
Today's celebration also marks the 25th anniversary of the very first licensed assisted living facility in the United States.
My name is Karen Brown Wilson, and I am a gerontologist. That is someone who works and studies in the field of aging. I was born in War, West Virginia, which is the southernmost city in West Virginia, and I spent my early years there.
66-year-old Karen Brown Wilson's story is featured in the book Being Mortal by Boston surgeon Atul Gawande. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for more than a year, and it tells the story of how Wilson revolutionized the way millions of older people live.
It really all started with my mom. My mother had a stroke at age 55, which is really young, and she lived for the next 10 years in nursing homes. And she was poor, so she was a Medicaid client, and that meant not very many choices for her. And when I told her that I was going to become a gerontologist, she said, well, what does that mean? And I said, well, that's the study about older adults. And she said, well, then why aren't you doing something to help people like me?
At the time, Wilson's mother, Jessie F. Richardson, was living in a traditional nursing home, which was based on the medical model of care.
Nursing homes were really stripped-down hospitals. People were in a ward. They were literally in a bed. They were told when to go to bed. They were told when to get up. They were told what to eat. They were told what they could do, what they couldn't do. They had no say in their lives, and that was very dehumanizing.
Wilson's mother let her know what it was like to have to live in a bed with few choices.
She wanted to have her cat. She wanted to be able to have her Vicks Vapor Rub in the drawer next to her. She wanted to go to bed when she wanted. She wanted to have temperature control. She wanted her own things. She said that because she was frail, she wasn't sick, and she didn't want to be treated like she was sick. So I just did my best to try to make her life easier, but she planted a seed, and I began thinking about how could we make life easier for people who needed support, who were not ill, but who were frail because of some disability. And that led me to think about creating a new form of long-term care, now called assisted living.
After becoming a professor of gerontology at Portland State University, Wilson and her husband, Michael DeShane, also a gerontologist, wanted to create a safe place for elders like her mother, but also a place where they felt like life was worth living. They borrowed several million dollars to build a facility.
We built this like an apartment house. We built it with locking doors, individual temperature control. We built it with a kitchen. And so you couldn't tell from the outside that it wasn't a normal apartment building.
The state licensing people went nuts, telling them, this is against the rules, that's against the rules. But Karen wasn't deterred. She camped out at their offices until she got them to give her a special license, and she wasn't through yet.
One day, literally, I was thinking, how am I going to do this for poor people? And I said, I'm just going to go back and say I can do it for less money. You give me anybody you want to, living in your nursing home, I'll take care of them, and I'll do it for a flat rate. And you can pick the people to send to me, and I want to do a pilot, and I want to show you that we can take care of people meeting any requirements you have for less money.
And at the time, nobody believed this could be done.
That's true. No one really believed it could be done. No one thought that we could give nursing care in a non-nursing setting. No one believed that people would be safe. I mean, people were convinced that it would kill people.
Against all odds, they succeeded. Not only did that early facility serve lower-income people for a flat rate, the pilot study showed that residents had better health outcomes than those who lived in nursing homes. The concept of assisted living, or more specifically, Karen's vision of it, was born.
So, Jean, we're on our way south, about 45 minutes south of Portland, to Canby, Oregon, which is where the first licensed assisted living is. And that is a building that my husband and I built. It is a small building and it has 25 units. Canby, Oregon is a small farming community, and it represented the kind of place where people didn't want to leave their community could stay in their community and receive care. I love Radcliffe. It's like a child to me. There's something special about this place because I had this vision that a small place could work, and that meant they could go in lots of small communities.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm Lori.
Built in a wooded setting, from the outside, Radcliffe Place looks like a large one-story craftsman home. As you walk in the door, immediately on the left is a wall of photos of young adults from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, the current residents of Radcliffe. We pass an elegant living room, a beauty salon, a laundry, and a dining room with a choice of menu items.
One of the things that's unique about this is the design, because it's in a square with an interior courtyard, so you can't get lost.
In the beautiful courtyard with shrubbery and flowers, we see residents walking their dogs. Cats are around too.
This was the model of what we would call resident-centered care, where the schedule is built around the resident and not the home.
How did you resolve this issue between the residents' desires and safety?
I was told once by a person I respected a lot is that what we want for ourselves is autonomy, and what we want for those that we love is safety. And so we came up with the idea called negotiated risk, which we try to figure out what are some reasonable actions we can take to help people do what they want to do. So it's trying to moderate risk or manage risk.
This new model of care for the elderly got lots of national media coverage. Shortly after, Karen was approached by investors from Wall Street to take the idea public. For the next few years, she oversaw the building of hundreds of assisted living facilities across the U.S., which included 3,000 employees in 18 states. But in the process, she felt her original vision got lost in the desire for profit and the fear of liability if someone was hurt. By the end of the 1990s, Wilson left the world of corporate assisted living and started a foundation, the Jesse F. Richardson Foundation, named after her mother, to help underserved elders in the U.S. and around the world. The foundation's first big project was in Nicaragua. Working with an array of people in the community, Wilson developed the first assisted living facility in that country.
I began to think about all of the places in the United States where I knew there was no assisted living, where I knew there were no services, that even if we had a Medicare and Medicaid, it didn't make much difference because you couldn't get to it. And where did it lead me back to? It led me right back down to McDowell County, Mingo County, Wyoming County, where I was born.
Since then, Karen, through the Jesse F. Richardson Foundation, has been researching how she can help underserved communities in West Virginia. Gary Withers, an executive for Concordia University in Portland, Oregon, is on the board of the Jesse F. Richardson Foundation.
Karen, because it's her roots, is truly inspired by the opportunities and the challenges in West Virginia, and in particular, trying to find solutions for isolated elderly, elders who live in the hollows, elders who are not reached regularly by dental care or physical health care or mental health care. And she'll work with the local leaders and local communities to be able to craft solutions that are organic to West Virginia, that are West Virginian solutions. Karen epitomizes what it means to be a philanthropist. But even more importantly, she's an extraordinary American visionary.
One issue where Karen wants to help is with the number of grandparents raising grandchildren because the parents are addicted to drugs. Though the project is still in its early stages, Karen's husband, Michael DeShane, has no doubt that she will be successful.
Karen's is like driven, you know, very different than I am, and that's probably why we managed to stay together. I'm, you know, we'll get through this, we'll just do this, let's build the building, let's take our time, and she's, no, we gotta do this, we gotta do that, we gotta do this. There's just something inside her that pushes her and pushes her and pushes her.
The drive inside Karen Brown Wilson was nurtured in West Virginia.
I was born in war, but I believe that the name of the mining camp that we lived in was called Bartley.
She was the seventh of eight children. The family was very poor.
There was a flood. We lived on this little creek, and I can remember my dad putting me on his shoulders and taking me across this swinging bridge and walking down the highway to a coal tipple. And then we had to cross the coal tipple to get back on the other side of the river. I can remember the Red Cross coming, and I got a new pair of shoes. I can remember walking down the railroad tracks with my mom. She'd have a sack, and she'd be picking greens. She'd point out, this is one we can eat, we can't eat this one.
Wilson's father was a coal miner who got black lung early on. He died when she was in grade school, and her mother decided to send the three youngest children, including Karen, back to the hollows of East Tennessee to live with a grandmother. Neither of Karen's parents went beyond the eighth grade, but education was very important to them.
My parents loved to read. I think that's how I learned to read before I went to school. And my mother and father felt that no matter what we didn't have, what we would have is school.
A seventh grade teacher made a big impression on Karen.
Mrs. Duncan told me, you know, you could do whatever you want. You're a smart girl.
And you believed her?
I did believe her because my mom had told me the same thing. So that was two adults that had told me that. And don't worry about what other people think. And that was a really positive message. And the thing that I learned from that message is that it's really important to be thoughtful about what we tell children because they remember.
All but one of Karen's siblings went on to earn college degrees. Karen decided to go as far out of the hollows as she could get and received a scholarship from the University of Washington in Seattle. Karen and her only surviving sibling eventually both earned PhDs.
Your brother that's still living is rather well known in his own right.
That's right. We call him Rocket Boy. My brother's Quentin. He was one of the group of boys that was written about in the book Rocket Boys and in the movie October Sky. He lives today in Amarillo, Texas. We talk several times a week, and he was a role model for me. He was always the brainy one. I like to say that I'm living proof that the war on poverty worked for one person. I was very, very fortunate to get a scholarship. And my brother says that winning the science fair was what allowed him to go to college. So we both benefited from the generosity and the investment that others made in us.
And in turn, Karen Brown Wilson generously gives scholarships to young students. Not only that, her ideas and drive have transformed the way millions of older Americans live. Today, there are more than 40,000 assisted living facilities in the United States, and thousands more worldwide.
You founded a worldwide industry. Today, it's probably worth hundreds of billions of dollars. People call you a revolutionary entrepreneur, the mother of assisted living. What do you want to be remembered for?
I would like to be remembered as someone who cared about those who had less than they needed to live comfortably. I would like to be remembered as someone who believed that you could make things happen if you put your mind to it. I don't know what else more I could want except to somehow be able to do more for others.
Where does that come from? What drives you?
From a religious perspective, there is the perspective that those for whom much is given, much is expected. My mother This is a true story. When my dad was sick and we didn't have much to eat, a hobo came to our door asking for money, and my mom said, "I don't have any money, but you can have supper with us." And we had oatmeal for supper. And I asked her why she was giving away our food, and she said, "There are those that could do and don't. There are those that would like to and can't. And there are those that can and do, and you want to be the third kind of person." We always are able to do more than we think we can. And I just want to do as much as I can.
You've been listening to Season 6 of Inspiring West Virginians, men and women from the Mountain State who are outstanding leaders in science, engineering, and business. Inspiring West Virginians was produced and presented by Gene Snediger. The senior producer for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is Suzanne Higgins. The Inspiring West Virginians theme music is by Roma Yagnik, choral music by Anton Bruckner, Antonio Lotti, and Clint Eastwood, all performed by the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, under the direction of John Oliver, other music by Ed Bowes and Jerry Milnes. Special thanks go to West Virginia University, the International Women's Forum in Washington, D.C., to Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, Keio University in Fujisawa, Japan, to the Jesse F. Richardson Foundation in Portland, Oregon, and to Davis and Elkins College in Elkins, West Virginia. Inspiring West Virginians is made possible by the ongoing support of the Miles Family Foundation, inspiring West Virginians to soar.